KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
60 years ago, Earth was attacked. We won the war, but they destroyed half the planet. Everyone's been evacuated. Nothing human remains.
There's always concern, but I mean, what our focus remains is that we're going to do everything we can to make sure that Boeing is successful here in Puget Sound for decades to come.
On this lovely spring evening in our nation's capital, I am honored to stand with you, proud to be the leader of the Liberal Party of Canada.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the new Tom Cruise movie, Oblivion, and those big science fiction movies that make a lot of noise and have a lot of special effects, and compare them to some of the smaller movies. Which do you prefer? Connie Kelleher was talking about the Machinist Union, from the Machinist Union, was talking about the Boeing expansion in South Carolina. Michael Parks will talk about the impact of that decision on the Northwest. And you heard Justin Trudeau, his acceptance speech after being elected leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. He has been keeping us abreast of what was happening in Canada and what was happening with Justin Trudeau. He joins us on the phone. Hello, Vaughn.
Good morning, Steve. And I just wanted to, I was listening to your Boston coverage there online, and I just wanted to pass on one thing. The newspaper that I work for, the Vancouver Sun, organizes a run every year, and it, as it happens, it's this Sunday. It's a 10K run, the biggest in Canada. And obviously, as with any other marathon, there's a security concern in the wake of the tragedy in Boston. Just a couple of things that I think are worth noting. In terms of sympathy in Canada, first of all, the run is going ahead. Second of all, the organizers are asking the people, if they can, to wear the colors of the Boston Marathon, yellow and blue. The third thing is, been a surge of registrations. Twice as many people have registered in the last 2 days as registered in previous years. So far from avoiding the run, people are flocking to it. It obviously will begin with a memorial for the people in Boston, but it is going ahead on Sunday.
What kind of additional security measures are police saying they're taking?
I assume there will be some. Vancouver police don't like to discuss these things ahead of time. And I think you can understand why law enforcement officials don't, but obviously there'll be heightened security. I mean, random acts of violence are hard to prevent, as everybody knows, and so not too much can be done. But I think the story I saw, about 250 British Columbians were in the run in Boston, right? There's a large number of people go down from Canada as well. You know, I think runs will go ahead everywhere, but obviously, in this context, the first thing to get to, for the paper and for everybody else to note on Sunday morning, is to remember the victims.
Were any Canadians victims? Do you know?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. The one person that I knew that was running it, the bombs went off about 10 minutes after she crossed the finish line. I think a lot of I don't know the answer on the other question.
Well, as you say, though, a race being run and a memorial to start it in Vancouver. Vaughn Palmer's our guest. Yeah. So what do we learn from Justin Trudeau's ascension here? Vaughn, you've been telling us about it for a while.
Ascension, I think, is the right word. I was listening to the clip that you used of Justin Trudeau. And one of the things that strikes Canadians is the degree to which his voice sounds like that of his famous father. Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister of Canada for a very long time, from elected in 1968 in a surge of public feeling that was called Trudeau-mania, and went on to govern the country through with one short interruption until he stepped down in 1984. Well known as a major figure in the country's history because of his role in creating the Canadian Constitution and our Bill of Rights and a whole bunch of other issues, angered many, many people in my part of the country and in the West because of his energy programs and so forth. an arrogant man with much to be arrogant about, as someone said. He was brilliant. He was a constitutional scholar. He was a lawyer. He was charismatic. He was disdainful. He terrified journalists. I've been in press conferences and was intimidated by him along with everybody else. So that's the dad. He died some years ago. His son, Justin, overwhelmingly chosen to lead the party his father led. On the weekend, 80% of the vote in a ballot of party members and supporters. And, well, we're getting a little flurry of Justin mania in the coverage across the country. Lots of public interest. The killer picture out of that convention was him on the stand beaming with his lovely wife next to him and holding his two kids in his arms. I mean, he's a young man. He's 41 years old. And he definitely has his father's charisma. Whether he has his brains and political judgment and leadership qualities is a matter of debate for the future, but it was definitely a big political story in Canada the past week.
When will we hear that debate come to the fore?
Well, he has a seat in Canada's parliament, so he's immediately plunged into that. He has also been paid the great honor of attack advertisements immediately. So that tells you you're getting somewhere when the government's attacking you. The Conservative government of Canada under Stephen Harper is known for its absolutely ruthless attack ads, which have been very effective in the past. They certainly helped destroy the last two leaders of the Liberal Party. And they were out with attack ads against Trudeau already. I think the real test for Trudeau will be the substance issue, whether he turns out to be more than, to use the crude expression, just face. There's a lot of, he's unproven in a, and I think it's fair to say that. His father, when he entered politics, was one of the country's leading constitutional scholars, a major intellectual figure, a university professor, he'd already proven himself to be a fairly effective politician. The son, relatively unproven, nothing like his father's credentials. And I think, you know, I think that's where you suspend judgment. You go, okay, you've definitely done the first thing. You've captured the public imagination. You've got the leadership of the party. He inherits the party, too, when it's in third place. And his father became Prime Minister of Canada at a time when his party was in power. So, and then he won an election. So, you know, the party was in a very powerful position then. Justin Trudeau inherits a party that's in third place. He faces not one but two formidable opponents, Stephen Harper, our Prime Minister, Thomas Mulcair, our opposition leader, leader of the New Democratic Party, and so he's in a tougher position than his father was, and he's got a lot to prove. So the pressure on him is incredible, and if he pulls it off, I think a lot of people will have to say, look, he pulled it off. This is not an easy situation he's been handed. We all know the story of somebody who generates a lot of public excitement, seems very charismatic, gets into office and proves to be a letdown. So we recognize that narrative arc, and everyone will be watching for his first stumble.
Yeah. Well, Vaughn, we have an election a little closer to home coming up here. It was just, as you write, was it only 4 years ago that we were talking about a BC election? And now we are again.
Yeah, British Columbia has a fixed schedule for its elections every 4 years, second Tuesday in May. And so the way it works is, in our system, they dissolve the legislature, which is a lovely image. They basically issue, there's 85 seats in the legislature, so they issue calls for 85 elections in BC. They're all held on the same day, but you vote for your local member, and the party that wins the majority of those seats forms the government, and the leader of the party becomes the premier. So that's the mechanism. So yesterday was the day they actually issued the election call. And, we have 4 week campaigns, although, you know, when you know the date of your election, as Americans know, the election starts long before 28 days. And so we've been in pretty much campaign mode here for months.
Does that show itself on
May 14th, British Columbians vote on whether or not they want to keep the Liberals for a fourth term. It's a long time to be in power under a new leader, Premier Christy Clark, who took over the leadership 2 years ago. Or is it time for a change? The leadership, you'd switch to the new Democratic Party, to Adrian Dix. Dix has been ahead in the polls for months. The mood here in British Columbia, according to the opinion polls, is time for a change. The gap between those two parties, 17 points in one poll that was out yesterday, 19 points in another. That's a pretty big gap to close in just 4 weeks.
It sounds like people do want the change from that poll anyways. Will they get it?
That's the mood. I mean, you know, I've covered enough elections to know, and we look at the elections around the country, that things do change during a campaign. There are gaffes, there are stumbles. Dix lost one of these candidates yesterday over some racist remarks that she'd made on the Internet 4 years ago, which came out. The government pointed them out yesterday, and he had to drop the candidate. So, you know, gaffes happen during a campaign. Lots of voters, too, Steve, even though the campaign's been going on for a long time and insiders have been following it, lots of voters turned their attention to voting just in the last few days before the election, so that can change it as well. But someone once said, time for a change has been one of the most effective political slogans in the history of electioneering, and I think we're seeing it here. The only way to really combat time for a change as a slogan is sort of just say, no, it's not. Change is risky. And I don't see that working all that well at the moment. We have two other parties involved in the election here in BC, which we might want to mention. The Greens are running candidates. They're poised. A lot of observers, me included, think they could win a seat or two. They have one seat in Canada's parliament for a national seat in the region of the provincial capital here in Victoria. And I think it's possible the Greens could win one or two seats provincially in and around the capital as well. They've got one of the country's leading climatologists running for them here in a suburb of Victoria, so they could win. And the Conservatives are running candidates as well. They've not been a major political party in BC and provincially for a long time. They're running candidates, and it's not out of the question they'd win a couple of seats as well.
Do you think you'd see any significant change in British Columbia policy if the new Democrats come in, well, for example, the carbon tax?
The new Democrats in the past, have the differences between BC's two main parties have been great in the past. The new Democrats were the government through the 1990s. They were driven from office, reduced to just two seats. It turned out to be a very unpopular government. So a lot of what they've been doing, Steve, is to say, hey, we're not that NDP, we're not scary like that, we're moderate, we're going to be careful, we're not going to do anything too radical. And so far that's connected with the public. Having said that, I think there's no question it would be more a stronger stand on the environment, on a number of issues. The carbon tax, they've already said they would add the carbon tax to the oil and gas industry. They would eliminate some of the industry's exemptions from the carbon tax, so they would do that. They said they would put extra revenue into transportation in and around Vancouver from the carbon tax. They are adamantly opposed to the big pipeline that would go through northern British Columbia, the oil pipeline. They do support fracking, liquid natural gas development. They're very down on tankers. They're very down on oil pipelines.
Vaughn, President Obama approved a big bridge project between Canada and the U.S., a big milestone for a lot of people. There's only one bridge that runs between Windsor and Detroit now. I believe it's a private bridge, and the person who owns that bridge did not want to see this new bridge get built, but it's going to be built, apparently.
Yes. The bridges across the connections between Detroit and Windsor, it's, I believe, still one of the big, it is still the biggest trade goods crossing between Canada and the United States. It's the heart of the auto industry. There are assembly plants and parts plants on both sides of the border. They ship goods back and forth across the bridge. And there's only one bridge, and it's privately owned, and Canada has been lobbying for a long time for a second bridge. It's a major project. The Canadian government has put up an awful lot of money to bankroll it. Been tied up in legal battles for a while because the owner of the private bridge does not want it to go ahead because he doesn't want to lose his monopoly. So, they didn't make a big deal of it. I guess the president has other things on his mind. But they did sign the federal permitting for it, which is another step forward. It may still be tied up in the courts. The owner of that bridge is very inventive at thinking of new ways of preventing the project from going ahead. So it may not be over, but it'd be a big boost to the economy on both sides of the border. That's why it's supported in both Michigan and in the province of Ontario, and why it's supported in Washington as well as in Ottawa, is because it's central to the whole trading relationship between the two countries. The auto industry thrives in part because of the easy movement of goods. And, of course, post 9/11, it hasn't been as easy to get stuff moving back and forth across the border.
$3.5 billion Canada is going to pay for the construction, and then the money is returned through tolls, a lot of those tolls from the Detroit side.
Yes, that's right. And there have been suggestions, therefore, that this is a sneaky scheme by the Canadians to make Americans pay for something that will mostly benefit the Canadian economy. And a lot of the back-and-forth political debate has been around that. But I think the real driver on this has been the fact that, you know, if you had a monopoly of a bridge that's that important to trade, you wouldn't want to give it up without a fight. And he hasn't.
Yeah. Well, all right, Vaughn, we shall talk again. Thanks for talking about Boston. It's always good to remember how that affects all of us. And I appreciate you taking the time again.
And we'll have an update on the BC election next week.
All right, sir. Thank you. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. Joins us every Wednesday on Weekday. Coming up, we're going into outer space.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
52 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for lots of clouds this afternoon and a high today of 58. Then rain coming in overnight with a low of 43, and tomorrow, Thursday, windy and rainy with a high of 53. 1022, I'm Bernard Ouellette. A look at what's happening with the local economy and the local business scene, including Microsoft, Boeing, and others, in 20 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Ah, yes, we're getting a treat. I was saying that we could someday just play the doot-doot at the very beginning, and that would be enough.
We will make it shorter and shorter every week. Right. That thing is so long, you do have time to go out to the lobby and get yourself a treat.
Thank you, Bernard. Very good. So that's all you need from now on. We're it's an earworm. Robert Horton is a film critic, longtime contributor to KUOW. He writes at the Herald and Everett. He writes at the Crop Duster. He has a monthly discussion on cinema at the Fry Art Museum, also at the Northwest Film Forum. And coming up?
Yes. You may also know me as the curator of the Celluloid Seattle exhibit.
I do know you as that.
Museum of History and
it's
Industry.
It's a different outfit, but I recognize
it. It is a slightly different outfit. It's got a cap and overalls, but I operate in that mode. And tomorrow night, Thursday night, Mohai will be having one of its monthly history cafes. And it's going to be a conversation between myself and a longtime Seattle film critic, programmer, teacher, Seattle's Richard T. Jameson, who is may also be known as former editor of Film Comment magazine. And we're going to talk about the history part of it is that we're going to talk about the sort of the Seattle art house scene going back to like the 1960s and 70s and how, you know, what was going on before the Seattle Film Festival was thought of and the Northwest Film Forum, as you just mentioned, was around. Because there was there were people and theaters that made Seattle a kind of an art house movie town. And we're going to look at some of that. Theaters like the Edgemont and the Harvard Exit in the 70s was a place where people went with a repertory calendar, you know, foreign films and old classics and so on. And we're going to hopefully we'll kind of dip back into that era.
Nice.
Talk about it a little bit.
Some of those folks are still around.
Some of those folks are still around, yes. And we'll bring that up. It's at 7 o'clock. It's actually a free event. I think it's a free event. Yes, I'm pretty sure it's a free event. But you can look on the MoHi website and check that out.
You know, a history cafe just conjures up, are you going to be like drinking out of, I don't know, circa 1890s coffee cups?
History cafe. Well, it's a we're in a kind of a new space in that old building that MoHi has revitalized. So I don't know if there'll be quite that mood. It used to be in an actual cafe, but now that the MoHi is in its new building on South Lake Union, it's next to the cafe there, which is very nice.
It's all very nice.
Yes, it certainly is. So please come by.
It is an institution of value.
Absolutely.
Walk around there.
It's
impressed neat, every time.
Yeah, it's a neat place.
And the work that was done outside by the historians to make sure that to bring in Native American impacts and culture into that area as you walk around that plaza and the park. Really remarkable stuff. You learn a lot. I saw Tom Cruise on The Daily Show last night. Calm. Very well represented in his kind of orange sweater.
Ah, I missed that.
Looked very good.
Oh, I like a good orange sweater.
Talking about his new burnt orange. Yeah. Talking about his new movie, Oblivion.
Yes.
Talking about how Morgan Freeman in any movie gives it gravitas because he's Morgan Freeman. Have you seen the movie?
I have seen the movie. Last night.
And I am a fan of the science fiction movie done well.
Good.
How is this one?
If you are a fan of science fiction movies done well, I think you will like this film because it has the atmosphere of old school science fiction in a way, while being completely, you know, the latest digital toolbox is definitely being used and it looks spectacular and it creates giant visions in the way that certain kinds of science fiction can. And I have to say, I think it also has a some heft to it. I don't know if gravitas is quite the word I'd use, but it's an ambitious film, or at least a very thoughtful one.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
an ambitious film for science fiction is they're going to be that big and explosive.
Yeah.
But we want. I mean, Tom Cruise has been in a few that have been like that. Minority Report,
yeah,
for example.
He did the War of the Worlds remake with Spielberg, which is a kind of an interesting film. And this one is the director is only known for one previous film, which was the Tron Legacy movie that came out a couple of years ago. Joseph Kaczynski is his name. And I was kind of underwhelmed by that, although, of course, it was visually spectacular because, it was all created digitally. And
younger Jeff Bridges was kind of interesting.
Younger Jeff Bridges, yes.
Digitally reconstructed.
Morphed into a younger version of himself. But this one took me a little bit by surprise because Oblivion is it's very deeply felt for one thing, and that comes out of almost every frame. But it's one of those movies where, yeah, these days you go to a big multiplex film and you have the expectation that it will be very loud and maybe it will just be one action beat after another. And this has a few of those for sure. But within that, they've tried to carve something out that's interesting, an interesting thing about memory and it's a post-apocalyptic world that Cruise's character is in, and so. They've lost all that, and he's also had his memory wiped, so he can't remember anything that happened to him in the past. It does a nice little job of working certain classic science fiction veins, I think.
You were asking folks to weigh in on this, and I hope you do. You can shoot us an email. You can give us a call at 206-543-5869. There's a other many ways the science fiction is represented in film and television, I guess, too. And there can be, well, your example was these big films with big statements and big product
All of the hardware, all of the designs, all of the, you know, the visions that you expect from that kind of science fiction. But then there's also that possibility of science fiction that's very small and that doesn't brandish a lot of gizmos and, you know, ray guns or spaceships or whatever might be the stuff.
What was your example? The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Was
yeah. One. Well, you know, the thing is I'm teaching at Seattle University this quarter and we're doing science fiction film. So this is very much on my mind. Plus, a bunch of movies are hitting the theater sort of right as we speak. And I was thinking about, you know, on the one hand, you've got Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which has almost no science fiction bric-a-brac at all. It's a totally normal small town. Something odd is going on there. And except for the pods, you know, that get carried around, which anybody who's seen the movie will not be able to forget, that's it. You know, there are no spaceships. There's none of that stuff. And on the other hand, you've got a movie like Forbidden Planet, which is all the cool stuff. You know, the robot. It's got the giant robot with the things and the ray guns and the motorcycle that runs on the planet and the vistas. Beautiful painted vistas of a planet with a green sky and two moons. You know, the stuff that we think of probably first when we think science fiction. That's what comes to mind. But I'm kind of intrigued by the fact of the flexibility of science fiction is you can go big like that or you can do this other. And there are a couple of new movies that go the small route as well that are out now.
Well, you remind me of Twilight Zone, which always was on television. It was always small. Just sometimes they would have makeup changes and the like, but often it was just a little bit of a set piece and the story.
They could do small with nothing, or they could do people on a rocket ship going somewhere or whatever. Yeah, they could play off either side. I mean, that Twilight Zone had the flexibility and probably the budgetary concerns.
And good writing.
Yeah, well, that helps. You know, it's interesting because budget can dictate the content of many movies. And if you're clever enough, you can make a science fiction film on almost no budget if you go this, you know, minimalist route, where if you don't have to build a rocket ship. You can, if your concept is cool enough. And as an example of that, one of the movies that had opened last week is Upstream Color, which is a film by the director Shane Carruth. Director, writer, actor, composer, etc. He kind of does it all himself on very, very low budgets. And 10 years ago, he had a movie that caused a lot of commotion, especially in the sci-fi aficionado world and in the world of internet chat rooms that try to figure out movies, where people have been talking about it nonstop since then, which was called Primer. And Primer was made for a few thousand dollars. But it's a science fiction movie, and it's absolutely a science fiction movie full of ideas, full of science, or at least stuff that sounds like science. Not quite sure how it all works, but that's one of the things that science fiction can do. You kind of just go with it. If you hear a lot of science talk, you say, yes, that sounds vaguely credible. I have no idea what it means.
Let me check my communicator because my dilithium crystals are...
Yes, they seem to be on the fritz.
Yeah, well, it's the tachyon beams.
Well, okay, see? See, that's all, and that sometimes that's all you need. And Carruth proved that with Primer, which is an insanely clever movie. And his new film, Upstream Color, evidently he has worked a little bit more, and he's got some special effects kinds of things going on involving what happens to something strange is happening to people's bodies, and it's affecting their minds. It works through them, but mysterious things are going on that alter people. But it still is a very obviously low budget, working on, you know, the level of ideas and concepts and playing around with time, which you can do in a movie even if you don't have a budget. You can start to jumble things up.
You said there were a couple coming out. Is that's one?
That's out now. That opened last weekend. And the other one, which I think qualifies as science fiction, is called Antiviral, which opens on Friday. And it is... a movie that is made by the son of David Cronenberg, Brandon Cronenberg. And I suppose it's possible that the son of David Cronenberg might have made a musical about happy people living in a Brooklyn condo or something like that. But he didn't. He didn't. He made really this twisted, science-heavy, body-obsessed movie, just like Dear Old Dad tends to make. And Antiviral is is clever. It kind of call, and it's obviously works on a certain budgetary level, and it does. It is reminiscent of some of the elder Cronenberg's very first couple of movies, where he was just going with ideas and very weird ideas and trying to not the the idea of entertainment didn't seem to enter his mind in any form at that point. He was just kind of intellectually intrigued by these thoughts about what the human body is and what machines are and, you know, what we're becoming and so on. And Antiviral delves into some of the same sorts of realms.
You know, well, we asked on our Facebook page, just for getting folks' response to whether they like the big films or the smaller films. And Cindy writes, smaller productions with minimal characters in suspenseful settings. That's a good definition of some of those, like a Twilight Zone in some ways, isn't it? And then Brad writes, I still don't understand the time travel film Primer, but it's a great example of the former, as you say.
Yes.
And then as CJ writes, no film with Tom Cruise.
Ouch.
I know, ouch. How is Tom Cruise in this Oblivion?
I will tell you that I think he gives one of his best performances in this movie.
Really?
I actually do. I think it's a very committed, very smart performance, I have to say. He's totally into it, and I think he catches some things, and he looks a little older than he used to, maybe slightly more seasoned, but I think it's a really strong movie star performance, I have to say. And he's on screen for almost the whole movie, because we're watching him, things from his perspective. So, yeah, I got to say, even if I know many people have become disenchanted with Tom Cruise because of things he's said off screen and ideas that he's put forward and so on. But in this mode, he's very good. He's very good in the film, and he carries it. In a really quite a strong way, actually.
So tell me, in this class you're teaching about science fiction, is it similar to your lectures where you're talking about how science fiction themes are reflected in political or modern culture?
Oh, like in that 1950s talk that I give? Well, you certainly get into some of that, yeah. And we're going sort of chronologically, so we have talked about, we are now still talking about the 1950s in science fiction, and that idea is one of the ways it operates. And we also talk about, you know, the film language and how it operates in a science fiction world. And
here, just for fun, we pulled two clips from a couple of science fiction movies just because it would be fun. This is one called Cosmos, War of the Planets.
I am Itor, chief of my people.
You killed one of my men. Why?
No. The immortal monster has killed your companion. Many of us have died. The Black Peril kills all those who dare to go out of the caves. We cannot do a thing against him. We can only hide in the innermost recesses of the planet.
There's one example of one of those science fiction films you're talking about. Whether it's big or small, good acting.
I'm not entirely sure that's a movie. I think that may have been your producers in the other room just recording something.
All right, well, here's the other one, which is, I guess, an example of not a big movie in terms of budget, but a pretty memorable movie and had enough, which was The Day the Earth Stood Still that Robert Wise directed in 51. Just listen to a little bit.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. The arrival of a spaceship in Washington. The Army has taken every precaution to meet any emergency which may develop. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Bernard Herrmann's music is happening there at the end.
Did you like that movie?
Cool. Oh, yes, it's a very, very good movie. I mean, that's got the spaceship and the robot, so it kind of covers the spectacle part of it, though most of it is a fairly intimate kind of story, I guess.
Which is sometimes not what science fiction will do.
Well, you know, you had the person email about liking the character-driven smaller stories, and I like that, but I have to say, I mean, if you're going to if you're going to have science, if science fiction is going to exist, and if movies are going to exist, I hope there will always be the spectacle. I mean, because that's what movies can do. It can bring those giant visions to life, and that can I don't want every movie to be like that, but that's a something that can be something special when it happens pretty well, as I think Oblivion does it pretty well. So I wouldn't want to go completely over to the other side, the primer side.
Here's what Mike in Kirkland says. We loved Safety Not Guaranteed, not really a sci-fi focus, but has that great time travel piece plot. Great Seattle movie as well. So well done little movies can be great, but we also love big sci-fi if they are done well. Robert, great job at the MOHAI exhibit. That is not to be missed. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
And you'll be doing your History Cafe there.
Tomorrow night. That's right. Well, I agree with I agree with that comment. And Safety Not Guaranteed is an example of something that relies on a science fiction idea but doesn't look like a science fiction movie for 98% of its running time, which is a kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
And this movie, Antiviral, is another example of that, although it's got a certain futuristic look to it. It portrays a world in which people are the culture has become so celebrity-obsessed that people are now you can get the virus of a famous person and take it on yourself, have it injected into yourself so that you have the illness of that celebrity.
Wow.
You were asking whether science fiction and the social commentary was still alive.
Yeah, so there you go.
I think you just turned green, Steve.
I did. All right, Robert. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. This is Weekday.
It's 10:40. We'll get some informed insight on the local economy and local business in a minute.
Hello, this is Dave Beck. KUW is grateful to everyone who participated in our recent spring membership drive. Now it's time to close our books. So if you've mailed in your pledge payment, thank you very much. If not, please send in your payment today. And thanks for supporting Public Radio, KUOW.
-52 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 58, anticipating mostly cloudy day. Overnight, rain coming in with a low of 43. And tomorrow, it's going to be windy and rainy with a high of 53.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Mercantile on Sandpoint Way and City People's Garden Store in Madison Valley, offering a wide selection of patio furniture and outdoor living accessories. Locally owned and celebrating over 30 years as a neighborhood resource. More at citypeoples.com.
10:41. I'm Bernard Ouellette. There are reports that a suspect has been identified in the bombing at the Boston Marathon. We'll get the latest from NPR News in about 20 minutes.
Yeah, the TV news channels are all over it, though. All they are over saying is maybe we have a suspect ID'd, and they said some good videotape was helpful from a department store and some police video as well, looks like. So we'll bring you more on that as they actually know more. Michael J. Parks is his website. He is a longtime financial journalist, joins us in our studios. Just talk to us again. Good to see you again, sir.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be back.
How do you feel about what our friend John Talton has been writing about Boeing? I think he blogged Boeing gone. He's a little upset about Boeing's decision to put a lot of money into Carolina.
I looked it up, and I quoted him wrong yesterday in my memo to you. The line was, Boeing's going. It rhymes.
Yes, it's much nicer.
You know, I think back 3 years ago, I think in July of 2010, a senior Boeing commercial executive came back from the Farnborough Air Show, and the line I remember was, we love Renton. We love Renton. And being the Panglossian that I am, I saw that as a sign that, Boeing really loves its workforce in the Puget Sound metropolitan area and will stick around. But as John observed last week, as Dominic Gates at the Seattle Times reported, Boeing's latest announcement is that it's going to put 1.1 million more into Charleston.
Billion
more, that's right, into Charleston, South Carolina, where partly in reaction to the 2008 machinist strike, it set up a production line to produce the new Dreamliner. The next day, a memo leaked out from a Boeing manager in Everett. I know it was a leak, but the Boeing manager informed manufacturing engineers at Boeing Everett. They said, thank you very much for fixing the problems on the 787 that resulted from our decision to outsource the airplane to factories around the world. And now, by the way, we're going to start laying some of you off. You combine this with the news within the last month that there are going to be both blue-collar layoffs and white-collar headcount reductions in the Puget Sound region. And I think John Talton, who deals in hyperbole, I must say, he is a friend, I think he has it right. We've been put on notice. I have often said that it is nowhere written in stone that the Seattle area will remain the premier place in the world for the production of commercial aircraft. There are other developments that bear on this. Within a few weeks, Mitsubishi will test fly a 90-seat commercial airliner, Japan's first commercial airliner. Japan was prohibited after World War II from building airplanes. But, of course, it has become a very active Boeing supplier. It supplies parts to all Boeing airplanes. About a third of the parts on the 787 come from Japan. So that's a threat at the low end. And Boeing's C-suite, based in Chicago, has put us on notice, essentially. I think that the long run that we've had is coming to an end.
You know, what's the first of all, we're still in the 60,000 workers alone in Boeing. What's the number on employees?
I think the Boeing number's in the high 80s.
Right?
Yeah, 87,000. And there are a lot of suppliers.
Right.
A lot of contractors. The total aerospace headcount is just under 100,000. About, last I looked, not quite 98,000. We've been over 100,000 three or four times since the dawn of the jet age. I was thinking back this morning to that sign at the edge of town in April 1971, 42 years ago. Will the last person to leave Seattle please turn out the lights? That was after the government withdrew support for the supersonic transport and after a recession where commercial customers canceled orders for the then shiny new 747. Boeing employment fell in a relatively short period of time from over 100,000 to fewer than 40,000. I don't think we're there yet. We have a much larger, much more diverse economy, but we may have passed the peak in aerospace employment and may be facing a long, slow decline.
What's the response that would be proactive from either the business community here or, if there's a role, government?
Yeah, good questions. Not sure I have pat answers. First, there are a lot of Boeing blue-collar people and white-collar people who are going to retire in the next 5 years, and I think Boeing will have openings for people who have the proper training. Our transportation system is a long-time Boeing complaint. They have trouble moving parts and people from their various sites. So we can work on education. We can work on transportation. We can't run a race to the bottom. Boeing is investing $1.1 million in South Carolina, partly because South Carolina is putting up $120 million in incentives. We've been there, done that. We put up $3 billion in tax benefits over several years to get the 787. Obviously, with public budgets tight, we can't play that game anymore.
Well, they're looking for some sort of breakthrough new technology, and you know, it's not on the horizon yet.
Right. There is a new version of the 777 coming. We have a state-funded aerospace office, which is, I think, leading the fight to make sure we land that project. But I think the governor's budget eliminates the funding for that office. It's a reflection of the fact that money's tight.
Well, you said that there was a theme emerging from these stories. Turn out the lights, party over, a sense of loss.
Yeah.
Microsoft is another example.
You know, we had a report last week from the consultants that keep track of such things that the shipments of personal computers in the January-March quarter fell not quite 14% quarter on quarter. It was the worst decline in the sales of PCs since records have been kept. IDC, which I think issued the gloomiest report, said that not only are customers not taking up Windows 8, the newest version of the operating system, it seems to be that the unfamiliarity of the interface is pushing customers away. And that the trend of movement away from the PC and toward the mobile device, the phone, the tablet, the other small screens, let's put it this way. It's going to hurt Microsoft. The Financial Times said this is not a slow-paced decline. Rather, it is an indication of a frightening sea change, and that has negative implications for Microsoft and, by extension, for the Seattle area and for Washington's economy.
But we have learned that Microsoft, because of its patents, gets money from when Android systems are sold and when Apple systems are sold. So is even though their lack of ascension in the mobile markets may have hurt them, they still have a foothold there through their ownership, don't they?
They have a foothold there, but most of the profit still comes from two legs of the stool. I'm not sure I'm using the right analogy, but the cash cows at Microsoft remain the operating system and the Office productivity suites. And Microsoft and Intel, which together dominated the business for a generation, both missed the boat in terms of mobile. And a reviewer at MIT's technology said last fall, there are a billion users of Windows around the globe. Windows is a civilizational tool, but when any one of those billion users sits down for the first time in front of a Win8 screen, he or she will, quote, recognize nothing, unquote. And despite the criticism, the lack of the start button, for example, the lack of the familiar desktop with their icons, Microsoft seems to be sticking to its guns.
Michael Parks is our guest. And by the way, Michael, CNN is now reporting that an arrest has been made in the Boston terror attack from two different video sources leading to those arrests. We'll bring you more on that in about 8 minutes. As they have some more clarity there.
Good news indeed.
Fisher Broadcasting, another example of, this is just a company sold. The company will still operate here. Does it loss of the headquarters have a negative?
A company with roots in Seattle that go back to a flour mill, go back more than 100 years. Again, I think John Talton, my friend, hit it right. We are just another branch town, or will be just another branch town to the new owners of Como TV, 19 other TV stations, many radio stations, including commercial stations that compete with us. The one way I think about it is the pool of volunteers, directors, and contributors to things like arts groups, the opera, the symphony, the ballet, or to the Science Center, for example, Pacific Science Center, other cultural nonprofit. The pool just got smaller because certainly, many positions in the C-suite, the corporate suite at Fisher Broadcasting based in Seattle, those are going to be made redundant. They're going to go away.
But do we have the opportunity here, and I know this is what you're talking about, do we not have the opportunity here to see the next generation, not just the next generation step up, but the next generation of doers and thinkers in the economy are cleared to find new innovative ways? And maybe they're not going to be as wealthy, but there are many of them who can contribute to the institutions you're talking about, but also to the economy. And so your example was the Bullitt Center, for example, at 15th and Madison.
Yeah, this week, is it? And I don't know, Steve, have you featured on KUOW the Bullitt Center?
A few times. And talked to those guys as they have built it and thought it through.
Interesting new building, energy self-sufficient, water self-sufficient, or close to water self-sufficient. No parking places. I guess the downside is the occupants so far look to be mainly the companies that designed it and were involved in the construction. But yes, we have a new generation of wealthy people coming up with fortunes derived from Amazon, from Adobe, from other high-tech companies, younger people who will have their chance to make a mark in all sorts of fields, including culture, including nonprofits.
Because there is still wealth here, and that wealth will support these innovations.
There's a lot of wealth, and more is being made. We have, for example, a company that's about to go public, Tableau Software. It's involved in big data, which is kind of a buzzword in technology these days, helping its customers make sense of the reams of data, the millions of bits and bytes of data that get collected every day.
See, so you can still have your Panglossian sense of things.
I can, but these developments, there's another one we haven't talked about, the oil majors, ConocoPhillips and Shell. They've spent millions, billions, trying to figure out a way to drill safely in the Arctic. They've essentially raised the white flag temporarily. There's an important point here. Tacoma is a jumping-off point for Alaska. The Alaska legislature has just passed tax breaks for the oil industry, $750 million a year, because Alaska has fallen way down in the league tables in terms of oil production. It's now fourth after Texas, North Dakota, and California. The flow of oil.
We're all using fracking technology.
They're using fracking technology, and the flow of the oil in the line has fallen so low that it really threatens the viability of the line.
Is that right?
Just
technologically, just in the way it operates?
The temperature has dropped because of less volume. There's more chance of water accumulating in the line, more chance of corrosion. They need to up the volume to keep that line viable. Who would have thought a few years ago, Alaska, well, 20 years ago, that line opened more than 2 million barrels a day. Today, a few barrels over 500,000 barrels a day. And as I said, the low volume threatens the viability. Who would have thunk it?
So Alaska banking on that dangerous and difficult offshore drilling to try to get back in the game?
They need to open up new fields, and the new fields in Alaska are largely offshore.
Well, we're at a cusp, it seems, in this region.
I generally wear rose-colored glasses. We've done better than average since 2005, but these developments have me concerned.
Well, we'll see if somebody like the governor and his statements that we need new direction and new industries, if there are breakthroughs in those industries, in energy and in other forms.
The governor has said that climate change is one of his top priorities. I'm a little bit discouraged by that because I think the governor should worry more about education, transportation, and public safety. But the governor is attuned to the idea of developing new energy-efficient industries, and that's important. So give him some credit for that.
Depends on where that money will come from, who will make the investments.
And that's a tough issue these days with budgets tight, with municipal bankruptcies in California, with issues. We had the AP series last week on the abuses of pensions in the old pension system.
Yeah. There's always news, Michael, that can depress us.
Lots to talk about. I'll try and bring rose-colored glasses.
Yeah. No, that's okay. You can find Michael J. Parks' writings at michaeljparks.com. You can also find him here every few weeks. I appreciate you being here again.
Thank you very much.
Weekdays produced by, Bernard Ouellette. He helps produce it, really, right? As our engineer. Produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Al-Sadi, Daniel Anthony Goodwin, our intern. We will talk to you again tomorrow. This is Weekday.
And that was your host, Steve Scherr, who will be back in the seat tomorrow morning at 9. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:59. Apparently there's been an arrest in the Boston bombing. We'll get that and an update on suspicious packages earlier today in Washington, D.C. in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net.
Some companies test for illegal drugs. We know that. Some now are testing for what's legal.
Before they are hired, they have a drug test that they take that detects nicotine use.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Freakonomics of smoker discrimination and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace. It's from 8 p.m.
Our evening business news roundup begins at 6:30 p.m. on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, finishing up its 50th anniversary with the comedy Boeing Boeing. Swinging bachelor Bernard is in for a surprise when his three stewardess fiancés all arrive at his flat in Paris. Boeing Boeing plays April 19th through May 19th. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.